All right, well, welcome everybody to the last morning session of the program, and we will begin with John Preskill. I'm very personally pleased to be able to introduce John, who will tell us about the ghost in the radiation.
All right, thanks, Mark. I'm glad to be here as always. It's been a very interesting week so far. I'm going to talk about work with Isaac Kim and Eugene Tang, soon to appear. And our motivation is to try to understand better how it can be that if the interior of the black hole, which has been evaporating for a long time, is encoded in a very non-local manner, nevertheless, local effective field theory provides a very accurate description of what's going on. What the title means is that we may be immersed in the Hawking radiation with the black hole interior all around us, but we can't touch it, we can't feel it. It's the ghost in the radiation, and we need to understand better how that works. To remind you of distant history, collisions with quantum information principles were already deepening our puzzlement about the behavior of black holes. Years ago, it was recognized that one can draw a space-like slice, a nice slice, through the space-time of an evaporating black hole with the property that the slice does not go near regions of high curvature and is crossed by most of the outgoing Hawking radiation emitted during the lifetime of an evaporating black hole and also by the collapsing body behind the horizon from which the black hole formed. So if quantum information encoded in that initial collapsing state winds up encoded in a very scrambled form in the outgoing Hawking radiation, that same quantum information is on a single space-like slice at two different places, so the quantum information is cloned, which is not compatible with the linearity of quantum theory. So it seemed that if information is not destroyed, cloning can occur. Either way, we have to rethink the foundations of quantum theory. And that led out of desperation to the proposal of black hole complementarity, which asserts that we shouldn't think of the inside and the outside of the black hole as two different subsystems of a single quantum system, but rather as two complementary ways of looking at one and the same system, with the outside view being appropriate for observers who stay outside the black hole. The inside view is the appropriate one for those who fall in through the horizon, and somehow a proper quantum theory of gravity has to help us understand how these two points of view can be reconciled. And the appreciation that this was a very strange idea deepened through the work of AMPS a few years back. They considered the case of a black hole which had been evaporating past its page time, so that the Hawking radiation being emitted now is actually purifying radiation emitted long ago. And if the principles of local quantum field theory apply outside the horizon, it should already have been entangled with this distant system at the time that it was very close to the horizon. And yet, on the other hand, if freely falling observers who fall through the horizon see what locally looks like the vacuum, then the system should be entangled with modes behind the horizon. So system B has very good reasons to want to be highly entangled with system E and also with system A, but that's not possible because quantum entanglement is monogamous. And so if we want to resolve that tension by saying that A is actually an encoded subsystem of the radiation, then that encoding has to be very profoundly non-local. So the emerging consensus is that this idea that the interior of a black hole, which has evaporated past its page time, is really encoded in the previously emitted radiation is on the right track. And we wish to understand how to reconcile that with locality, at least as an approximate notion. And I'll argue that ideas from quantum error correction, computational complexity, and pseudo-randomness, which is the main theme of the talk, can be helpful for understanding how those things fit together. The main idea I want to discuss is that the encoding of the black hole interior can be extremely robust in the sense that observers who are outside the black hole interacting with the radiation cannot influence the encoded interior if they are limited to performing feasible quantum computations on the radiation outside. Only by performing computations of superhuman, superpolynomial complexity can they influence the interior. So our ideas build on previous work by many people, some of whom are listed here, but we feel we have some perspective on the issues, which I hope you'll find instructive. I'll also remind you of how the idea of an encoded interior draws inspiration from the thermal field double state, as Maldesane and Susskind emphasized. In this case, we have a black hole, the one on the right, which is highly entangled with another system, namely the black hole on the left, and Hawking radiation emitted by the black hole on the right is purified by the system with which this black hole is entangled and also by modes in its interior, and yet the horizon is smooth to freely falling observers. How can that be? Well, it's because the system with which the black hole is entangled actually is the interior, and so it's consistent to identify the interior with an encoded system in the system with which the black hole on the right is entangled. And the idea is that that should be the resolution of the problem in general when a black hole is highly entangled with another system. So I want to explain the idea of pseudo-randomness, first in a classical setting, then in a quantum setting, and then how that's relevant to understanding the nature of the encoding of the black hole interior. So first, in the classical setting, let's suppose there's a black box which is emitting samples from some probability distribution on n-bit strings. And we're promised that that distribution is one of two possible ones, either what I've called P sub I, which is the completely uniform distribution on all 2 to the n strings, and the other called P sub s, which is uniform only on some exponentially small fraction of all the strings, but a set which still has exponentially large cardinality, 2 to the alpha n, where alpha is some number between 0 and 1. And we, by drawing samples, are supposed to guess whether we're getting samples from P sub I or P sub s. So in principle, this is easy to do, because after I've drawn a few samples, if the distribution really is P sub I, I'll draw a sample which isn't in the set S, and then I'll know for sure that it is P sub I. Or after I've drawn a few samples and they're all within the set S, I can be highly confident I'm drawing from the distribution P sub S. The trick is, though, that this set might not have any special structure which makes it easy to verify that the sample we've drawn is really from the set S. If it's an exponentially large set, we might not be able to do better than checking a lookup table with an exponentially large number of entries, and checking whether the sample is from P sub s in that way would take an exponential time. So we can back up the idea that it's hard to distinguish these two distributions by drawing samples with a counting argument. Now suppose we have a classical circuit, a computation that takes a sample from one or the other distribution, and then does some processing and is supposed to output either the answer, yes, I accept, it is from P sub s, or I reject, I think it's from P sub I. So fix such a circuit, and then consider a randomly selected set of 2 to the alpha n of the bit strings, and typically that will be fair enough sample. So the probability of acceptance, if I draw a string from the uniform distribution or just from the subset S, the probability of acceptance will be very similar in both cases. In fact, the probability averaged over all the choices for S that I can distinguish S from I with this particular circuit with a success which is larger than something that's exponentially small will be doubly exponentially small. And that's just for one particular circuit, but I can consider all the circuits of polynomial size, and the number of those is the exponential of a polynomial, which is still very small compared to the exponential of an exponential. So what that means is that for a typical choice of this set S, the probability that any circuit of polynomial size can tell the difference between a sample from S and a sample from P sub I, the probability that they can be distinguished with better than some exponentially small success probability will still be doubly exponentially small. So we can call the distribution P sub S for a typical S pseudo-random, meaning although in principle it's easy to distinguish it from the uniform distribution if we have enough time, we can't do so except with a tiny success probability in a polynomial time computation. And there's a quantum version of this game as well, in which the black box is emitting either a maximally mixed state or some pure state, and we're supposed to tell the difference after drawing a few samples. And in principle, that's very easy to do. I could do a two-outcome measurement, which either projects onto this pure state or onto its orthogonal complement. And as soon as I successfully find the orthogonal complement, I know it has to be the maximally mixed state. And if I successfully project onto psi a few times in succession, then I'll be very confident it's really this pure state. But the catch is that that measurement can be exponentially hard to do, because in fact, for typical states in an n-qubit Hilbert space, preparing a pure state takes an exponentially long quantum computation. So the idea that these are hard to distinguish for a typical psi for a polynomial time quantum computation can again be backed up with a counting argument. We can consider some particular observable which we measure by doing some quantum circuit and making a measurement and getting either the outcome 0 or 1. And for a typical quantum pure state sampled with respect to Haar measure, the probability of acceptance that the circuit says 1 instead of 0 will be very similar for that pure state as for the maximally mixed state. And in fact, I won't be able to distinguish the two with better than some exponentially small probability, except with some probability that's doubly exponentially small. So again, we can say, well, the number of quantum computations, the number of quantum circuits of polynomial size, is the exponential of a polynomial, and that's much less than the exponential of an exponential, which means that for a typical psi, there won't be any quantum circuit of polynomial size that can tell the difference between psi and the maximally mixed state with better than an exponentially small success probability. There's a question.
I was just wondering, in this setup, is there a reason that you're not allowing collective measurements, like the swap test?
I was just asking in this setup if there was a reason why John was excluding collective measurements, because then you could distinguish those two possibilities.
Well, I'm going to come to mixed states in a minute, and so I will, won't be in a situation where I can use the swap test. But I just want to emphasize at this point that, the typical pure state is going to look like a mixed state, right? But now I want to ask a more nuanced question, which is, is it possible that there are two quantum states which we could be sampling from where both can be efficiently prepared and it's still hard to tell the difference by any reasonable computation? Now, that's not going to work for a pure state that's efficiently preparable because I could always run the preparation backwards and check that the state is not the maximally mixed state. So I'm going to have to consider some quantum state which is mixed, but which is in principle distinguishable from the maximally mixed state, perhaps because it has much lower rank. And so in this case, I can argue that it's possible to have mixed states that are efficiently preparable, but are still hard to distinguish from the maximally mixed state. Well, when I say I can argue that, what I mean is, subject to an assumption, the harsh truth of complexity theory is there are a few things that we can prove from first principles. But what we often do is make assumptions, which we think are highly plausible, and infer their consequences. And in this case, the assumption that I want to make is the existence of what I'll call quantum secure pseudorandom functions. And what that means is that there's a family of functions indexed by some label little k, which lives in a space called the key space. And if I draw one of these functions, each of which is efficiently computable from this set, that there isn't any way with a polynomial time quantum computation to tell that it's not a random function. So let's say that that assumption, vetted by the cryptographers, is a valid assumption. And then we can see that it is possible to make a mixed state, which is hard to distinguish from a maximally mixed quantum state. We can do it this way. We can consider a family of states, which will uniformly mix, each one of them associated with one of these quantum secure functions, which is efficiently computable. And we can prepare a state in which that function appears in the phase of an otherwise uniformly random superposition of all the basis states. And then we won't be able to tell that this state is not a uniform superposition with random phases by any efficient quantum computation, because if we would be able to do that, we'd be able to tell that this isn't a random function. So this, for all practical purposes, behaves like a superposition with random phases, and the superposition with random phases is informationally indistinguishable, information theoretically indistinguishable from a maximally mixed state. Well, this was an observation by Ji, Liu, and Song just a few years ago. So there are pseudorandom states, hard to tell that they're not uniformly random, with polynomial time quantum computations that can be prepared efficiently. And so we will make the assumption that if that can be done, a black hole will be able to do it. Black holes are extremely effective scramblers of quantum information. And so if such pseudorandom states can be efficiently prepared, a black hole, it seems reasonable to assume, would be able to do it. Now, in the case of a black hole with a finite temperature, then I'd be trying to distinguish the state not from a maximally mixed state, but from a perfectly thermal state at that same temperature. The black hole radiation might be easy in principle to tell that it's not a perfectly thermal state, because it might have very low rank compared to the thermal state. But in practice, it could be very hard with any polynomial time computation performed even with a quantum computer. So the situation that I'm considering is this one. A black hole forms from collapsing infalling matter. It evaporates for a while. It's evaporated past its page time. The previously emitted radiation is the system E. H is the remaining black hole microstate. B is a recently emitted Hawking mode. And so B is entangled with the system, which is embedded in EH and actually can be decoded from E late in the evaporation process. And we want to interpret that as the encoded interior mode with which this recently emitted Hawking mode is entangled. And our assumption is that if an observer comes along and performs some polynomial-sized quantum computation followed by a simple measurement, that observer won't be able to tell that the radiation system is not perfectly thermal. So to say that a little bit more precisely, we consider some two-outcome measurement performed on the radiation, and the assumption is that that measurement won't be able to distinguish the actual state of the radiation from some perfectly thermal state, except with success probability, which is exponentially small. Exponentially small in what? In the size of the remaining black hole. It's the size of the key space, not the size of the system E on which the observer acts, which controls the security of the state, its indistinguishability from the thermal state. And so what we would like to see is that it will follow from this assumption, and also the assumption that the observer has some limitation on his quantum memory, that we can construct these so-called ghost logical operators, which we can think of as operators acting on the interior but which are unaffected by any observer who performs a polynomial time quantum computation on the radiation. So I'm going to argue this in two steps. And the first step will show that from the pseudo-randomness assumption, we can see that the encoded system in the radiation is hard to decode for any computationally bounded agent acting on the radiation. And then the second step will be to show that these ghost logical operators can be constructed. And for both steps, really the key thing is a decoupling argument, a statement about decoupling of the observer from this recently emitted mode B that follows just from the pseudo-randomness assumption. That is, we're interested in some encoded system which is entangled with this recently emitted Hawking mode B, and we'd like to know what the observer can find out about it, but it follows from the pseudo-randomness that before the observer makes his simple measurement, at the end, the observer and the system B are nearly decoupled from one another. That is, the joint system of the observer and system B is very close to a product state. How close? Well, its closeness is determined by the size of the remaining black hole, assuming the observer's memory is not too large. And the closeness is measured in the one norm, the trace norm, which is the right notion of closeness. It means that there isn't any measurement that can distinguish the state of OB from a product state, except with that very small probability. And that decoupling statement is what we need to show that it's possible to recover from the damage which is inflicted by the observer who acts on system E, who's going to somehow scramble up the encoded state. The decoupling means that there isn't any information about the encoded system which the observer is able to acquire, and that's the condition which turns out to be sufficient for the existence of some recovery map. And in fact, some recovery map has to exist which restores the original encoded state for any state in the code space, assuming the code space here has constant dimension. The recovery will succeed with some residual error, which will still be exponentially small in the size of the remaining black hole. So, first of all, this is telling us that we can't, with a polynomial size computation, decode the encoded system in the Hawking radiation. The observer isn't able to extract it into a small quantum memory that he carries around. And so this is a statement similar to the one made by Harlow and Hayden some years ago about the difficulty of decoding the radiation, but following from somewhat different assumptions. We wanted to emphasize that this statement can be made on the basis of the assumption of pseudo-randomness of the Hawking radiation. And it's also notable that the hardness of decoding has to do only with the size of the residual black hole. It still applies when in the late stages of the evaporation process, H is much smaller than E. What's necessary is for H to be macroscopic and still contain many qubits, in other words, for it to have a large Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. And in addition, we're making the statement that it's possible to recover from the error under the pseudo-randomness assumption for any computationally bounded observer. From a quantum information point of view, this is a rather novel statement in the theory of quantum computation when we're interested in using quantum error correction to protect a quantum computer from noise. We usually assume a rather benign form of the noise, which we think or hope is realistic in the laboratory, that the noise is rather weak and only weakly correlated among the different afflicted qubits. This is a very different kind of noise model. Our observer is able to strongly affect the system E. The noise can be chosen adversarially. It can be highly correlated. It can be anything that the observer can do in polynomial time. So how is it we're able to conclude that it's possible to recover from this very harsh noise? Well, it's because there's a system H which we're assuming is noiseless. The observer who's inflicting the noise on the system doesn't have access to H. And it's this noiseless key space, even though it can be much smaller than the system E, which makes it possible to recover from the damage inflicted by the observer. So now, let's talk about these ghost logical operators. This is easiest to discuss in the case when we can do quantum error correction exactly. So suppose we have a single qubit, which is encoded, and we want to be able to recover perfectly from any errors which are in some set of correctable errors or any linear combinations of those errors, errors labeled by E sub A, E sub B, and so on. One thing that will be required if we can recover from that error exactly is that for any choice of the errors, acting on orthogonal basis states for that encoded qubit, the states remain orthogonal after the errors act, because otherwise the perfect distinguishability of those orthogonal code states would be lost and perfect recovery wouldn't be possible. And that has to be true no matter how we choose the basis in the code space. It has to be true also for the conjugate basis where the states are 0 plus 1 and 0 minus 1 if we're going to be able to recover perfectly. And it turns out that these conditions, aside from being necessary, are also sufficient. So let us define an operator, the Pauli operator acting on the code space, which is the Pauli operator Z. It has eigenstates 0 and 1 for the logical encoded qubit with eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. And there's a corresponding logical operator which is diagonalized in this conjugate basis with eigenvalues plus 1 and minus 1. So those are the Pauli operators acting on the protected system, but we can extend them to the linear span of the errors acting on the code space, saying that their eigenvalues are still the same after the errors act, and there's no obstruction to doing so because these error correction conditions are satisfied. So in that way, we've constructed operators which act not just on the code space, but on an extended space which can be reached by errors that are correctable acting on the code space, such that the action of the errors commutes with these logical operators acting on the protected code space when acting on the code. So the errors, if we start out in the code space, don't have any effect on the logical system described by these encoded Pauli operators Z and X. And the technical thing we had to do in our paper is show that a similar, by we I really mean Isaac and Eugene, that a similar statement holds in a more subtle setting of approximate quantum error correction, where we have these exponentially small errors, but which could still have effects which are difficult to control in an analysis. But it does work, so we can show under this pseudo-randomness assumption, under the assumptions I've already stated, that the black hole radiation state is a pseudo-random, that its deviation from a perfectly thermal state to a computationally bounded observer is controlled by the size of the remaining black hole, and that the observer has a memory which is small compared to the Hilbert space of the black hole. Under those assumptions, the approximate error correction criteria still are satisfied so that we can construct these ghost logical operators which now approximately commute up to some exponentially small error acting on the code space. And those are our candidates for robustly describing the black hole interior. So to summarize the story, we can plausibly argue that the Hawking radiation emitted by an incompletely evaporated old black hole is pseudo-random. So Stephen Hawking was almost right when he said the radiation was thermal. In practice, it is. Computationally bounded realistic observers can't tell the difference between that radiation state and a perfectly thermal state, even though in principle the difference can be detected, but only by a superpolynomial computation. And then that follows that these computationally bounded observers are decoupled from the system which is entangled with the encoded system, which we want to represent the encoded black hole interior, and that decoupling is quantified not by the size of the radiation system, but the size of the remaining black hole. That implies the Hawking radiation is hard to decode under the pseudo-randomness assumption, as long as the remaining black hole is still large. And it means that locality is fairly well protected by computational complexity. In principle, you can make a firewall, you can create an excitation at the horizon, you can influence an observer who's behind the horizon by performing some operation on the radiation. It's just too hard to do so. It requires an infeasible computation of super polynomial complexity. If you're able to do those very, very powerful quantum computations on the exterior, then the whole semi-classical structure of the space-time can break down. Space-time, in effect, gets torn apart, and we can no longer rely on our semi-classical picture of the geometry to say what operations are possible. The observers on the interior have access to the key space for the pseudo-random state, the black hole microstate, so they can perform operations easily, which are too hard for the observers who are limited to acting only on the exterior radiation. And we can also consider somewhat more powerful scenarios for the observer outside. He might have a very large probe which interacts with the Hawking radiation. That will mean the encoding of the interior gets modified. It'll now be encoded not just in the radiation, but also in the probe. But our observer with bounded complexity and bounded memory size still won't be able to have any effect on that encoded interior. So one lesson we could state is that for effective field theory to be a good approximation, we're accustomed to requiring low curvature and low energy, but it's also implicit, or should be, that we're considering operations of low complexity. Otherwise, the predictions of effective field theory can fail badly. All I've shown is that encodings with the desired properties exist. I haven't given you any concrete argument why these should describe the experience of observers who fall into the black hole and interact with the interior degrees of freedom. The encoding of the black hole interior is actually state dependent in general, in the sense that it depends on the initial state which underwent gravitational collapse. Is that a problem? Well, it does bother me that these operators which describe the interior have some dependence on the state. Maybe that means that we still haven't properly understood the right way of thinking about measurements that occur inside black holes. We can hope to make contact between what I'm saying and what we've heard earlier in the meeting about islands, disconnected components in the entanglement wedge, and how information in such islands is encoded in the exterior. And it would be interesting to understand better the connections between the way I've described the complexity of the decoding and other views of that complexity, for example, the Python's lunch scenario that we heard about earlier in the meeting. What I've been saying really makes no direct reference to ADS-CFT. That's an advantage and a disadvantage. It means I can't say anything very concrete about how this encoding gets realized in a particular model, but it also means that the general principles that I've articulated might have broader applicability. And perhaps as we understand better the properties of these encodings, we'll be prepared to do quantum gravity in a broader context, including studies of early universe cosmology. All right, thanks a lot for listening.
Questions for John? Yeah.
Could you please go back one slide? So you assumed that the remaining black hole is noiseless, and then you drew the conclusion that under limited computational power, we cannot really affect the interior, which is the remaining black hole merge. It seems like a cycling argument that you already assumed that noise cannot affect the interior, and then you draw the conclusion that under limited computational power, the interior is well protected. So
why isn't it circular?
So, I mean, like, it seems that I can go directly from my assumption to draw the conclusion that I already say it's noiseless, and which means I cannot do much about that. It's not really affected by the outside noise. And then I draw the conclusion that, okay, from the outside, under limited power, of course, I cannot do much of the inside. So maybe I have confused some points.
Well, of course, I guess one way of saying the question is, why didn't I just assume the answer in the first place? That the interior is well protected. Well, the assumption that the Hawking radiation is pseudorandom is an assumption, so it's just an assumption. The reason I'm comfortable making it is the reason I tried to explain, is we actually do know that it's possible to efficiently prepare pseudorandom states. And then I'm making a bit of a leap in saying that if it can be done, then a black hole would be able to do it. The actual computational complexity of the construction that I showed you of these pseudorandom states depends on exactly how hard it is to evaluate the pseudorandom functions in that family. And that's really the limiting step in that construction. So I am making a rather strong assumption about how easy it is to compute these functions in the pseudorandom family, that it's easy enough for a black hole and its evaporation time to be able to do it. But then I think there is a thread to the logic to go from there to the difficulty of decoding and the construction of these logical operators that commute with the computationally bounded observers. And so there is a theorem lurking behind the curtain which showed that this construction of the ghost logical operators, technical details of which I did not explain, works in the context of approximate quantum error correction.
I think my main issue is not with the assumption of pseudorandomness. I'm kind of confused about your connection with pseudorandomness and the other assumption that you say, like, my remaining black hole H is noiseless. I think mainly I have questions with the assumption that the remaining black hole is noiseless.
You're not assuming the interior is just contained. The interior is sort of somehow combined in H and the early radiation. So noiseless on the H doesn't mean it's automatically noiseless on the interior.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so when the black hole is completely evaporated, right, then you don't have H. But we still expect that the interior exists, right? So I was wondering whether maybe there is some other assumption one could make that would also make this apply to that case. Maybe you could say that you act on a fraction of the qubits in the radiation or something like that. Do you think we'll have to make an assumption like this?
So your statement about the interior still existing after complete evaporation, I guess, is a statement about the interpretation of the Penrose diagram,
yeah,
of the space-time, that there's some
gravity,
stuff behind
yeah,
the horizon yeah. that hits the singularity.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So, of course, the analysis is not being done at the level of such a semi-classical description. The pseudo-randomness is controlled by the size of this key space. In other words, the rank of the density operator that the black hole is supposed to be generating. And my statements just cease to apply when the black hole is very nearly gone and that key space is no longer very, very large. I can no longer claim that it's hard to tell that the state isn't a thermal state. And of course, when the state is completely evaporated, assuming no information is lost, we have a pure state. So now we're back in the situation I described where you can run the preparation backwards and tell that it's not a thermal state. But I think your assumption was reaching for something deeper, or rather your question was, is there some other assumption that we can make which will tell us something about the remaining interior after complete evaporation? And at least in this setting, I can't make any such statement.
So in one of the talks on Monday, Tom made the point that if I have a thermal density matrix on a space of rank e to the s, then I can add non-perturbatively small corrections in the entropy and turn it into a pure state. So what I'm wondering is, from the perspective of this computational distinguishability problem, is there a way of thinking of the distinguishability of a pseudo-random state versus a thermal state in terms of those matrix element corrections?
It sounded like Don Morrell, but I never did see where you are. Oh, no, it's out. Okay. Hi. So let me see if I understand the question. You're saying that I'm talking about the distinction between a state which is really thermal and a state which is not, and is there some sense in which I can describe them as being close? Namely, I can add exponentially small terms to the off-diagonal density operator to turn one into the other? Well, that may be true, but I don't see how it can be, I don't see offhand how to connect that mathematically to my statement about pseudo-randomness.
John, on the last sentence of the slide, you say when H is no longer very large, what's the typical size when you get in trouble?
Well, it's when e to the minus the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is no longer a very small number.
Okay.
Yeah, John, first of all, I want to make an advertisement for a paper, which I think is a very important paper. It did not appear on the HepTH. It appeared in the Quantum. It's by Bulund, Vazirani, and Pfefferman. You probably know the paper. And it's also about pseudo-randomness. The question I had, which will not make any sense unless you read that paper, is whether there's much of a connection between what you're saying and what they say. What they say, the conclusion of which, is that the dictionary between bulk and boundary is necessarily extremely complex.
Yeah, so I like that paper also, and in fact, if I'd had more time, maybe I would have spent 5 minutes discussing it, because I think it's it would be an interesting thing to discuss at this meeting. So the paper
I'll try a little bit.
The paper you're referring to by Bulund, Pfefferman, and Vazirani says the following thing, that it should be possible to prepare a pseudo-random state on the boundary by hitting the boundary with some sequence of shocks, and that now, from the boundary point of view, that means it's computationally hard to distinguish that state from a random state. But then, in the case of the state which has exponential complexity, which really does look like a random state on the boundary, it seems from the bulk point of view, that should be easy to distinguish from the pseudo-random state, because one has an extremely long wormhole and the other has a very short wormhole. And so what are we to conclude from that? They say a possible inference is that the computational complexity is actually occurring in the dictionary, which relates the bulk to the boundary. And I think that's a very interesting statement, and perhaps an important one to come to terms with as far as the meaning of holographic duality is concerned. Your question was, what does that have to do with what I'm talking about? Nothing directly that I can see, except I think in both cases we are emphasizing the importance of pseudo-randomness for the purpose of interpreting what's going on behind horizons.
That's fine. I just wanted to advertise the paper.
Mm-hmm.
So just to clarify, is your picture then fundamentally compatible with or incompatible with the idea that information or entanglement simply transfers from the black hole subsystem to the outgoing Hawking radiation?
Entanglement can be transferred. Say it again.
Is your picture compatible with or incompatible with a picture where the unitarity is restored, so to speak, by processes which transfer entanglement from the black hole subsystem to the environment of the black hole, to the outgoing Hawking radiation?
So you mean
that's a possible
nonviolent non-locality a la Giddings? Or?
That's one version, yes. That I think is a simple way of solving a lot of our problems. And so I'm trying to figure out if somehow that's compatible with this picture or if this is just fundamentally different.
I guess I'm not sure that, we're in the same ballpark, but, I'm just talking about modeling the evaporating black hole by some highly chaotic unitary.
Sounds like a good ballpark, but okay. We have to be specific about the unitary.
Okay. So. And and that's why, why the pseudo-randomness is relevant, and, actually, I probably didn't say this out loud, but that statement that the radiation is pseudo-random could apply not just to a black hole, but to other highly chaotic systems. I wouldn't claim that that means that, the interior of a lump of coal is described by these ghost logical operators.
Okay.
In the case of the black hole, though, because there's a horizon, we do have a compelling reason for trying to understand the interior as encoded in the exterior. You're asking a more detailed question about the dynamics and how
asking,
to reconcile it with the semi-classical picture, I guess.
Well, and also, again, more asking if it really is essential to adopt a kind of ER equals EPR point of view on this, or if you really could take the same viewpoint in terms of the random unitaries and so on, but have a situation where you are simply transferring entanglement from the black hole to its surroundings through some interactions that we haven't discovered yet.
Yeah, what I'm trying to do is rather different, I think. I'm saying that let's say that we want to believe that the interior is encoded in the radiation. How can that be true, and yet we can't, kick somebody around in the interior just by fiddling around with the radiation? So I'm sort of taking the ER equals EPR point of view as a premise and trying to construct the algebra of operators that would describe the interior that would be compatible with that picture.
We should continue after,
right,
but I
yes,
guess information
this is fascinating, and I'm sure there are many more questions, but sadly we are out of time, and we'll move on now to Matt Hedrick, who will tell us about something, which...